Welcome to Independent Truths with Scott Atlas, brought to you by the Independent Institute, my show that tries to bring a uniquely rational perspective to several of today's important issues. Today's guest, Professor Michael McConnell. Michael is the Richard and Francis Mallory Professor and Director of the Constitutional Law Center at Stanford Law School, and also my colleague as a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. From 2002 to 2009, he served as circuit judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 10th Circuit. Michael teaches courses on constitutional law, the First Amendment, and interpretive theory. He has published widely, of course, in constitutional law, especially Church and State, Equal Protection, and Separation of Powers. He's written several books, including The President Who Would Not Be King, Executive Power Under the Constitution. McConnell has argued 16 cases in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. He earned his J.D. from University of Chicago and served as a law clerk to Supreme Court Justice William J. Brennan. In government service, he's been Assistant General Counsel of the Office of Management and Budget, Assistant to the Solicitor General of the Department of Justice, and a member of the President's Intelligence Oversight Board, and currently he is co-chair of META's Oversight Review Board. Michael and I have a conversation about some of today's most controversial issues involving the Constitution and law in the context of presidential power and the separation of powers, including immigration, censorship, and free speech, on-campus protests, and the fundamental concept we hear quite a bit about in the news, the so-called threat to democracy in the United States. Thanks for joining us and stay tuned. Okay, Michael McConnell, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Hey, thanks, Scott. This is great.
There's so many things happening, of course, because, as a layman, as just an ordinary citizen, I feel like suddenly the Supreme Court, the Constitution is in the news every day. And perhaps that's related to who the president is. Perhaps it's related to the sort of politicization of everything and the new sort of vitriol that we see most days. But I want to talk about some of these issues that we're seeing on the news as regular citizens trying to understand, and many of them center on the power of the president, which to me is very striking because we're a country that was formed with very clear checks on power of single branches of government and the so-called separation of power. First of all, is this new, these battles over sort of the power of the president in general, or has this historically always been there?
Well, let me begin just by saying my general perspective is to try to look at what the president is doing and what the courts are doing. You know, each one is a legal matter. And I think there's a tendency like to make massive generalizations. Oh, this is, you know, we're descending into dictatorship, or, oh, the courts are running amok. And actually, I think it's somewhere in between. And I think it's important to keep perspective. You know, is this a new thing? Well, the sheer volume and pace of President Trump's actions, I do think, is unprecedented, at least back to FDR, and different from FDR because he had a large majority in Congress, and a lot of what he did was send proposals to Congress, which they then passed. Well, President Trump can't do that, and so it's much more unilateral than then. But we've never seen so many actions of such controversial nature so fast. Now, every one of the recent presidents has done things which pushes the envelope, some of them very dangerous, and all of them have been rebuked by the courts. There's nothing new about the court stepping in, but the sheer magnitude right now is different.
Is it true? My perception is that the power of the use of executive orders, maybe, but the intentional use of that as a tool has been increasing over the past four or five presidencies. Now, I wasn't really conscious of what was happening beforehand. Maybe it always was used.
No, there is a real difference here because I think Mr. Trump has a somewhat different attitude about what executive orders are about. In the past, executive orders have been used much more sparingly from, you know, major issues that actually require a presidential directive. And most of what presidents accomplish, they accomplish by picking up the phone or having a meeting or, you know, something like that. But instead of doing that, Donald Trump likes to issue an executive order. And they're much more conspicuous. And what they do is they have the effect of concentrating public attention on him, on the White House, on the center, whereas many presidents have wanted to have the actions, you know, out in the agencies so that, you know, the criticism is more diffused. And I remember I had my first legal job in the Reagan administration, and I can remember observing that every time the Washington Post liked what President Reagan did, it was done by the agency, always an agency action. Whenever they didn't like it, well, it was a presidential decision, whether he had anything to do with it or not. Well, Trump makes them all presidential decisions.
Mm-hmm. But of course, with these presidential executive orders, it seems like they can easily be reversed by the subsequent president.
Yeah, that's a real weakness in this style of government, is it's not permanent. And it's actually, I think, not good for our system to flop back and forth with quite different policies on major things, where one administration does one thing, then the other one immediately on the first day reverses half of that, and then the next administration reverses that. It makes it very hard for people who have to live under these rules to know what they're doing. And in the economic sphere, it's especially damaging, because how do you invest when you don't know, you know, what are the tariffs going to be? What are the, you know, all these things? It makes it very difficult.
Right. The uncertainty, of course, in the practical sense, particularly in business. And let's talk about some of the topics that are, you know, affected by these executive orders and right on the table, front and center every day in the news. The first one I'll start with is this idea of tariffs. I mean, to me, I am stunned. Whether you like the tariffs or not is not the question. The what's shocking to me is that a president, a single person, can go in and simply declare national, international level direct policies that can be taken effect immediately, and sometimes industry specific. You know, they change every other day, it seems. I mean, what is that? Is that even legal? And why I ask that in that way is because, of course, we already see lawsuits by industry, by states, by so-called people of standing, I guess, in the legal jargon. I mean, what is that even possible, that these things can be just simply declared like that?
No, we'll find out. But I think not. So the Constitution is quite clear that the power to impose tariffs, which is called imposts and duties, these are taxes, that this is vested in Congress and Congress only. And so if the president has such authority, it can only be because Congress has given it to him. And President Trump has invoked a statute that was passed in 1977 called the International Economic Emergency Powers Act. And that act does not even mention tariffs. It does not say that he has tariff powers. It has like seven different verbs for things that the president can do, and none of them involve imposing taxes.
And what are economic emergencies under that
this would be the most famous is the Iranian hostage crisis, where President Carter and then President Reagan affirmed major economic sanctions against Iran in response, and then lifted them in response to the return of the hostages. So this is an example of where you really do need to move fast, and you know, you can't fool around and wait for Congress. And those were examples of that. Originally, this power was just for wartime, and then it got extended under Franklin Roosevelt to other emergencies. But still, the power is economic freezes. So you can freeze assets. So we do this, we've done this, say, with Russian oligarchs. Right after the Ukrainian invasion, we imposed a number of these sanctions. Mostly this means freezing people's bank accounts, or in some cases, if the property is located in the United States, confiscating the property. That's what this act is really about. And the one reason we know it's about this and not about tariffs is that it was passed in conjunction with and just after the Trade Act of 1974, which does give the president tariff authority, but the tariff authority it gives is for very short-term tariffs for very specific reasons with specific procedures that have to be followed before it can before they can be imposed. So when Congress does give the president power over tariffs, it never puts him on a long leash. It's like, you know, this is a very tightly, jealously guarded power of Congress. And the idea that for essentially any reason, the president can just start asserting it, I think is beyond the scope of the statutory authority. And can I make just one other aspect
sure,
of this?
Sure.
Is the emergencies, because this is about emergencies. And what President Trump has identified may be extremely serious problems. I'm not arguing the underlying economics of this, although I tend to be
yes,
a free trader, but you know, I could be wrong. I mean, I don't set policy. I don't set anything, actually, but certainly not policy. But he has made reference to trends in our balance of trade that go back 25 and 30 years. These are not emergencies. These are chronic, persistent, long-term issues.
And by definition.
And that's just not. And he also proposes the tariffs in order to raise revenue. He has apparently one of the purposes is to raise revenue in order to help finance the perpetuation of tax cuts and to help solve our or mitigate our budget deficits. Well, that's not an response to an economic emergency of an international nature. So I don't think there's a proper emergency within the meaning of the act, but even if there were, tariffs are not authorized because all tariffs are in a separate statute and President Trump hasn't even pretended to be invoking that statute because he.
So if you had to predict, because there are lawsuits about these tariffs.
Yes, there are about six lawsuits so far.
And if you were a betting man, you would bet that the president would lose some of these lawsuits.
Yes, but it may take a long time. That's part of the problem with all of this is that the way the procedural statutes are set up, the president has a real advantage to be able to move quickly and the courts move slowly. And the tariffs are taking place. I mean, people are paying the tariffs today. And so the effect is today. And I mean, the longer term effects will be in a month or two, right? I think we're going to be feeling the effects more severely, but the immediate effect is today. And how fast are these courts going to operate? We just don't know. That's why we hear a lot about TROs around the country, not just in the tariff case. There hasn't been one yet in the tariff case, but in a whole bunch of these different areas, temporary restraining order, TRO.
I see.
And this is where a court has an order based upon almost nothing, the filing of a lawsuit. And then the purpose of a TRO historically has been just to freeze things in place for an extremely short period of time, like under 10 days, just to freeze things so the case isn't over before it can be heard. So the TEBRA is based on almost nothing. And yet the courts in the last, just maybe 20 years, this is a new phenomenon in American history. Courts have been issuing these nationwide orders that can stop the administration in its tracks.
And that alone, that specific act is a subject of significant controversy, correct?
Very much so.
In other words, the authority of a lower court, meaning anything less than the national Supreme Court, really, somehow can stop a national act.
That's right. And there's a feature of our system that makes it worse, makes it especially problematic. And that is, we have hundreds of district courts. And all it takes is one order to stop something. So the president might be able to win in the first case, in the second case, in the third case. But case number 10 comes along, and if the district judge is persuaded, then the president loses. So the system
is there a precedent
in a way that that favors stopping the president? I'm sorry,
but is there a precedent on limiting the authority of a lower court when they try to have a restraining order or an injunction?
There is not a clear Supreme Court precedent. This is because it's a relatively new phenomenon. And then I think it really started in earnest under Obama, that recently. Because it's so new, we just don't have a lot of law on it. Some circuits, that is the circuit courts, there are 11 regional circuit courts. Some of them have been reversing these orders, saying, district court, you can decide the case, you can issue a TRO, but it only applies to either the parties that are before you, so you can give relief to the actual people suing, or in some cases, they say, just to the district that you're in, geographic limitation. Some of them have said that, and some of the Supreme Court justices in separate opinions have said that that should be the case. And some academics have been arguing that, but it hasn't actually, there's been no decision. This may very well be one of the first consequential things that the Supreme Court does in response, because there are several cases before the court right now that raise this. There's several cases in which the administration is not even challenging the district court's decision on the law. I mean, because there really is no decision. All there really is a temporary thing. And what the administration has done is appeal to the Supreme Court on the specific issue of, can there be a nationwide order like this? And every president has complained about this. I can remember hearing Obama's attorney general giving a speech about how terrible it was. And I didn't even mention one of the weird things about all of this is that plaintiffs get to choose where they bring their lawsuits. And, you can't necessarily pick your judge, but when you pick where you're going, well, the judges in San Francisco, I don't think there is a judge in San Francisco that isn't, pretty much a liberal Democrat. And I don't think there's a judge in the Northern District of Texas that isn't pretty much a conservative Republican. And that means plaintiffs are able to go to the place where they're most likely to get a favorable decision at this low level. And if those judges have the power to govern for the whole country, it's a real problem. And then getting that reversed can take time. In the ordinary course, when things are slow and you get briefs and you get arguments and deliberative decisions, it can take years, 2 or 3 years. So by the time the Supreme Court, issues a decision saying, oh, no, you shouldn't have done that, well, the president's policy has been stopped for three or four years. And when I say the president, it's not just Trump. This is something that, I mean, whether you like the president or you don't, you know, we do elect them and we expect them to be able to accomplish things. And when the district courts just can stop them in their tracks, it's a real problem.
Is it true that you said that the plaintiff has a choice of judge or not judge, but jurisdiction. This is a separate issue. It's a naive question about criminal proceedings. Criminal proceedings, I mean, I would think that in our system, as a general rule, the defense has a benefit of the doubt. I would think a defendant would have the choice of jurisdiction.
Yes, there's a specific provision in the Constitution itself requiring that criminal trials take place in the vicinage and the place where the crime takes place. And also there are other specific types of challenge that only go to a particular court. So we were talking about the tariff issue. The government has been arguing, and they may be right, I haven't studied this, they may be right, that all of these cases have to go to what's called the Court of International Trade, and that's a specialized court. It sits in New York City. The reason for that was that most litigation about our trade laws is about, you know, it was a fairly technical litigation about, you know, how various tariff schedules work. And it's like very specialized area of the law. And so this court, that these are real experts in that, but now these cases are being thrown in their lap, which isn't about the narrow details of trade law. It's like, can the president do that? You know, so they have this, it's one of the most important constitutional questions in modern history is whether the president can do this, can impose tariffs, remove tariffs, change tariffs, go on X, Twitter, I still think of it as Twitter, and go on X and announce new tariffs like overnight. Can he do that? Well, that's a really important question. And it very likely will be decided in the first instance by these judges in a court no one has ever heard of and who are experts in trade law.
Speaking of money, one of the things that is another area of presidential authority and the question of it is university funding. This is in the news. You know, you and I both work at Stanford, so we're also acutely aware of these issues. You know, there's federal grant funding, there's future grant funding, and of course, this is in the news in part because of student protests, et cetera. But in terms of the money itself, what about the authority of the president to simply declare, or any administrative agency declare, you're not getting any funding, you're not getting any NIH grant, you're not getting any relief of student debt on your students that's really a federal funding issue? Where is that authority?
So this is somewhat up in the air. I mean, I would say very much up in the air, because let me give you sort of the extreme positions, and my guess is the real answer is going to be somewhere in between. On one side, the executive branch has the power to give grants in its discretion. And let's say you have a statute that appropriates a certain amount of money for research into, I don't know what, you know, clean water or something, whatever it happens to be, health, I don't, whatever it happens to be. Well, the agency will make specific grants to Harvard or Stanford or Ohio State based upon their judgment about, you know, who's doing the best work. And that's not reviewable. It's in their discretion. The grant will go to who the executive wants. There's also a provision in the regulations that grants can be canceled when the executive branch thinks that they are no longer serving, that particular grant isn't serving its purpose.
Specific grants can be canceled.
Specific grants can be canceled. So the administration is taking the position, and it's not obviously wrong that that means they can cancel these grants. They can say, well, if you're an institution that's harboring anti-Semitic, incitement to violence, well, then, you don't get the grants. And I want to emphasize, this is actually a tool that has been used by progressive administrations in the past for things that they don't like universities doing. So, I mean, for example, they threatened every university with removing their money if they did not make much more severe the procedures for adjudicating student sexual assaults on campus. These are the so-called Title IX proceedings. And my opinion is they demanded that universities remove due process. I thought it was entirely inappropriate.
On the accused.
And that was done with a simple letter called a Dear Colleague letter that told universities, if you don't change your procedures, we're going to take away all your money. Well, that's essentially the same thing that this administration is doing to Harvard, but in the service of different policies. It was never challenged. Universities just caved in. And then the first Trump administration reversed the policies, and then the Biden administration reinstated those policies, and it's been one of those back and forth things. Well, there was almost no public outcry because, I mean, in this world of ours, the big megaphones are held by one side of the political spectrum. Well, now when Trump is using them for these other purposes, well, now suddenly there's more of a problem. So that's one side, is maybe the president really does have authority over grants, at least future grants and maybe even present grants. Now, at the other end of this are some other ideas. One is that all final agency action and the withdrawing of a grant would presumably be that is subject to judicial review under the Administrative Procedures Act and can be overturned if it is, quote, arbitrary and capricious. That's the statutory language, arbitrary and capricious. And courts are prepared to say that this canceling of grants to Harvard are arbitrary and capricious because the reasons for them don't seem, particularly persuasive, at least to many people. So that's a possibility. Another thing is that there seem to be procedural protections, at least for a lot of this. To withdraw money from a university because it is discriminating on the basis of race, sex, ethnicity, et cetera, the usual litany. This is Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. That requires procedures. You have to bring actual complaints, and the university has a right to defend, and there's going to be a proceeding, and there have to be hearings, and so forth. So when President Trump says that Harvard is engaging in anti-Semitic activity or condoning anti-Semitic incitements to violence, if that's a Title VI accusation, and I think it is, it looks like it, then he can't just yank the grant. He may very well be right. I don't know, but he has to go through the proper procedure.
And when you say that there's a required procedural route, what do you mean it's required? It's in the law?
It's in the statute.
Okay. Because what we think of a lot of things, I don't know, again, I'm just a viewer of these things. I see at least what's been interpreted as very arbitrary ignoring of laws. For instance, let's talk about immigration. There are laws Well, or even the student loan. First, I want to talk about student loans, actually. Here, President Biden forgave student loans, basically. And the Supreme Court said, you can't do that, if I'm correct.
You're correct.
And then he said, well, that's too bad. I'm doing it anyway. I mean, so I'm sort of shocked, if I am correct in this gross oversimplification of what happened. I'm shocked that we are seeing people just simply disregard the Supreme Court decision, or is that not really what's happening?
Well, I thought that was pretty shocking. So what President Biden did is he says, well, I'll do it another way. And so he, you know, slightly changes the justification, but does the same thing, and not just once, several different times. And this amounted to an expenditure, because forgiving loans is an expenditure under our laws. It amounted to spending, just the first one alone, and then the others are even more, over $400 billion, which is a huge expenditure without congressional authorization. So this goes to the heart of Congress's power of the purse. This was a blatantly unconstitutional act, in my opinion, and the Supreme Court said so. And then President Biden proceeded to do it anyway. And how much of an outcry was there about, oh, do we have a constitutional crisis? You know, because the president is defying, you know, the orders of the court. I don't actually remember hearing that. I'm sure there were some right-wing news outlets that said things along those lines, but I sure don't remember hearing it in any major mainstream sources. I didn't hear the Democrats in Congress getting all upset about it. Now, President Trump has not done that. In his first term, he did order the spending of some money on the on his border wall that Congress had refused to appropriate. And the court said, you can't do that. I think the court was right then, just as they were right in the Biden case. So far in Trump 2, we haven't had any instances of this. But as you mentioned, in the immigration cases, they have come awfully close, if they haven't actually jumped over the line into saying we're not going to comply with orders from the Supreme Court. This is a very serious thing. It's not that it's the first time in American history, but it's the first time in recent American history, and the instances in the past are not remembered as being good points. They are remembered as having been, you know, real problems then. And to have it happening now under successive presidents is very disturbing.
Thanks for listening to part one of my conversation with Professor Michael McConnell, Stanford Law School. Stay tuned for part two.